This is The Sweeper, the global football podcast with the best worldwide news and stories from the beautiful game, with Lee Wingate and Paul Watson.
On this episode of The Sweeper, we tell the story of North Korea's mystery cancellation of their match against Japan, reflect on Georgia's historic first ever qualification for the Euro, and discover the wonderful world of ground hopping. Hello, hello, and welcome to another episode of the Sweeper podcast, where we tell you all the best stories from around the football world. My name is Lee Wingate. I'm joined by my fellow host, Paul Watson. And today we're going to be telling some stories we didn't yet cover from the last international window, putting the groundhopper community in the spotlight and announcing a once-in-a-lifetime competition. But it's the international segment up first. We're going to kick off with the story of North Korea's mystery withdrawal from their World Cup qualifier against Japan. Paul, what can you tell us about this?
The game was supposed to take place in Pyongyang. North Korea had played Japan in Japan. Japan won that 1-0. The next game was supposed to be the reverse fixture. And there were rumblings in the days before the match that possibly this fixture wouldn't take place. And the reason for that wasn't very clear initially. North Korea refused to host the match. So the game was effectively, by default, would have had to have been moved to a neutral ground. But because this was being done 5 days before kickoff, there wasn't any realistic chance for teams to sort of relocate somewhere and play the game. So initially, it was really unclear what was going to happen and why. That was the other thing. Why would this be happening? The official reason that has now been given is that North Korea refused to let players from Japan enter the country because of fear of this outbreak of a disease in Japan that's happened, a disease that's been called STSS. It's streptococcal toxic shock syndrome. It's actually a really horrible virus. It's spreading quite rapidly in Japan. And it has like a very high fatality rate. So there is obviously a really horrible virus in Japan. But the strange thing is that North Korea would have allowed its players to travel to Japan to compete and then suddenly say they can't come to us. What we do have to remember, though, is that North Korea locked down incredibly hard from the coronavirus pandemic. You know, they absolutely shut down any kind of travel. And only last month, a qualifying match for the Olympics between the women's teams from Japan and North Korea was moved from Pyongyang to Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. And that was because the Japanese football authorities said they were having too much difficulty basically getting documents to be allowed to access North Korea. So in a way, you can look at this and say this is yet another example of North Korea behaving in a rogue fashion. But you could also say this was a very slow motion problem that was always on the horizon. And it's just strange this wasn't sorted out weeks in advance, because they could have played this game somewhere else. Now, North Korea will be forfeited from the game. They'll lose 3-0, and it more or less ends their chances of progressing in the World Cup.
Yeah, very strange one, this. I know that at the time of the pandemic, there were a lot of worries about what would happen if the coronavirus made it into North Korea, because the country famously has a pretty poor healthcare system. There's limited access to medical equipment, supplies and medicine. There's a lot of malnutrition as well, which obviously makes the population vulnerable when it comes to the outbreak of diseases. But it does still surprise me, as you say, that they were willing to go ahead with this match if it was in Japan, because surely then some of their players could catch it and then bring it back. So that's the thing that I don't really understand about all of this.
It does sound like maybe something else was going on. Maybe, again, it's a case of a North Korean attempt to put pressure or to make a political statement, or there's something that they were trying to do that goes beyond the official message, which wouldn't be unusual given North Korea's sort of track record. What will be interesting to see is that they still have to host Syria and Myanmar in June in North Korea. From this point on, which way will it go? Will the North Korean authorities and Football Association, will they engage properly in dialogue and work out another place to host these? Will they do the right things in that way? Or, as you fear, having been effectively sanctioned for this withdrawal, will they double down and effectively withdraw? Will this be the end of their campaign? It's really hard to say, but as ever, it's sad to see football matches not take place. It's sad to see opportunities being taken away from footballers. And I'm sure North Korea's footballers have an awful lot more to worry about than just football, but it is sad, really.
They did last take part in the World Cup in 2010. And I think it's worth revisiting that tournament because there were some very memorable moments from their group stage campaign. They were drawn in a group with Brazil, Portugal, and the Ivory Coast. And I think for me, the two stories that stayed very firmly entrenched in my mind from that tournament were, first of all, and I think you know what I'm going to say here, Emmanuel Eboué.
Yeah, I do indeed. And his very great acting skills in pretending he could understand the messages being passed on, wasn't it? He sort of sneaked up to the North Korean player getting instructions from the coach as if he was sort of eavesdropping. But I'm not sure how good Emmanuel Eboué's Korean is.
Yeah, it was just the sort of the way he was nodding his head ferociously as if confirming he'd understood absolutely everything, and the way that the North Korean coach and his player just completely ignored him. If you've not seen this, go onto YouTube and type Emmanuel Eboué North Korea and you'll find it. But it's truly wonderful. The other one is that North Korea famously almost never show live games. So in this tournament, they lost 2-1 to Brazil, and that game was shown 17 hours after it happened, by which time a lot of the population had managed to find out the result through various media sources. I mean, can you imagine? Your country is at a World Cup for the first time in, I think it was the first time for them in 44 years since 1966 that they'd been there. And they had to wait 17 hours to watch the game. And then they agreed, after losing only 2-1 to Brazil, that they would show the game against Portugal. And they lost that one 7-0.
Yeah. Well, there's this strange thing that obviously the regime in North Korea doesn't want to show weakness. And that is very difficult when a North Korea team does go to a World Cup because they are going to be underdogs. They're likely to lose games. But when you actually look at it, I always think with North Korea, the real story is how this nation manages to punch so high above where you'd expect it could, given its isolation and given its economy and given its problems with famines. And, you know, North Korea, you would think, would be an absolute minnow in football terms, but especially their women's team seem at such a high level. So it's quite a funny thought that they would not allow people to watch for fear of losing. And actually, that game against Brazil was an incredible achievement when you think about it.
Yeah, only losing 2-1 against Brazil at a World Cup. I think there was one more thing that struck me from that tournament. There were lots of rumours that the North Korean fans were not actually North Korean, that they were Chinese and that they bought the tickets that were allocated to North Korean fans or government officials. And there was this rumour going around that they steadfastly denied that they weren't actually North Korean fans. So the whole situation around North Korea in that tournament was fascinating, but their weight to take part in another World Cup will go on, it looks like, at least another 4 years. While we're on the topic of international stories, we're going to round up a couple of quick ones from Europe. Georgia, we have often said that we were hoping that one of these sort of outsider nations would make it into this Euro. I think we both sort of had our eyes on Kazakhstan and Luxembourg, but as it is, Georgia have made it into their first ever Euro.
Yeah, and this is a great example of where the Nations League comes into its own, especially for nations of Georgia's sort of tier. They have perfectly executed the game plan to use the Nations League as their pathway into their first major tournament. And I think it's brilliant when you look at the fact they were playing Gibraltar, North Macedonia, Bulgaria, and then they've managed to get themselves through to this playoff. And you know, the playoff was pretty tricky. It was an absolute nail biter against Greece, that's for sure. But yeah, to see what it means to people in Georgia and see those eruptions in the stadium, it's something really special. You know, when you see a team get to a first tournament, it's always very special.
I tweeted directly after this game that Georgia were the only debutant as an independent nation at this upcoming Euro. They did actually technically take part as part of the USSR before, but as an independent nation, this will be their debut appearance. It was very quickly pointed out to me that actually Serbia are also making their debut as an independent nation, having previously only taken part as the former Yugoslavia. But to me, they're a little bit different. And I couldn't quite put my finger on why that was until somebody pointed out that according to FIFA and UEFA, Serbia are the official successor nation of Yugoslavia and Serbia and Montenegro, whereas Georgia are not the successor of the USSR. So kind of they are the only debutant and kind of they aren't.
That's really interesting. I mean, it certainly feels like a debut in a way, whereas Serbia doesn't. You're right. I feel exactly the same. That is very interesting that Yugoslavia has to have a successor, given how incredibly fraught that conflict was. You know, to have to say which of these nations now is the official successor to Yugoslavia feels like a massively loaded political question. I wouldn't want to make that decision.
I think it might be because they are the largest nation that, you know, was in the former Yugoslavia, and they've therefore decided that they inherit previous accomplishments by the team. But as you say, it's a slightly strange one. We had a good comment on our Discord, one of our patrons, Richard Pike, writing, "I suspect that a certain German town is delighted at no Greece versus Turkey game, because the group that Georgia will now go into is with Turkey, Portugal, and Czechia." And I think that what he's saying there is, given the sort of unfriendly relations between Greece and Turkey, it probably is quite a relief to the German police that that game won't be taking place.
That would have been a really, really fraught derby, wouldn't it? That's a fair point. Yeah, I bet they were watching that penalty shootout about as nervous as the rest of us. It was a horrible shootout to watch, that one, with so much at stake.
Certainly congratulations to Georgia anyway. We'll be rooting for them in the summer and we'll probably be talking about them closer to the time. Another country that I'd like to give a little mention to, and I actually try not to do this sometimes on the pods because I'm based in Austria, so I don't want to talk about Austria too much, but I feel we kind of have to, because in the whole conversation about dark horses for a tournament, Austria are right up there at the moment. They scored that fastest goal of all time against Slovakia that we talked about on the last pod, and then they thrashed Turkey 6-1. Quite a statement.
Yeah, I mean, you're a lot better placed to say than I am, but what's happened? You know, what has turned this team around? Is it Ranić? What's happened?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is Ranić, basically, because there was a coach that was in charge before, Franco Foda. He's now in charge of Kosovo, actually. I just had the feeling there were so many talented players in this squad and he was essentially holding them back. And it got to the stage where, despite this incredible generation of players, there was such disillusionment here about the national team. I think one of his final games in charge was a friendly against Scotland, and it was only attended by about 6,000 people. It was a tiny attendance. And Ranić's come in, and I think now since September 2022, they've lost one game, and that was narrowly against Belgium. So they've done incredibly, and I've seen them a few times. I saw them against Germany in that friendly in November where they won, but I also saw them in the Nations League against Denmark and France, and we weren't making the pod at this time, but there was a really eventful game against Denmark and a story that I never got the chance to tell. So I figured I would tell that now, because if I don't tell it now, I'll never tell it. This was the story of their Nations League game against Denmark. And you might remember this because of the sinkhole. Do you remember the sinkhole?
Yeah, I do. I do. So this was the game with the sinkhole. Yes. You'll have to refresh our memory on exactly how this happened.
The first thing that happened at the game, we got there around 7:30 for an 8:45 kickoff. And the game was delayed by 90 minutes because there was a power cut in the second district of Vienna, which is where the stadium is located. So the stadium and, you know, thousands of houses in this district of Vienna were without power. But I think probably even worse is that the second district is home to the Prater Amusement Park, which is the second oldest amusement park in the world. It's appeared in a lot of popular culture, films such as The Third Man, James Bond, The Living Daylights. It's quite well known. But unfortunately, it's also in the second district and was also affected by the power cut, which meant that any people, you know, in various positions on rides were stuck.
Oh, no.
But from our perspective in the stadium, it ended up taking a couple of hours for the power to come back. The game eventually kicked off at around 10:15. So it finished at midnight. And when it finished at midnight, Austria had lost to Denmark. It was 2-1. And this was only around a year after the Euros, where Denmark had got to the semi-finals and obviously done really well. But at the very end of the game, the players were trudging off the pitch, and there just a sinkhole just opened in the turf, just a massive hole. And it was really deep as well. One of the Danish players, Andreas Skov Olsen, put his leg inside the hole to show how deep it was. And it was like close to up to knee height. So there was just a massive, just massive hole. And I remember seeing this doing the rounds on Twitter. I mean, it didn't look good for Austria, I have to say. But yeah, that was the night of the sinkhole.
Wow, that's incredible. You just don't expect to see that in a nation like Austria, do you? I mean, with the greatest respect, you don't expect to see it anywhere. But if you heard about this happening in Myanmar or, you know, a lower ranked nation, you might think, okay, Austria, to have a sinkhole in your pitch. It's kind of amazing nobody got hurt from that, isn't it?
Yeah, very, very fortunate. Anyway, Austria will surely be the dark horses for this tournament, even though they're in a group with France, the Netherlands and Poland. I think they tend to do quite well with this sort of fast transition-based football against teams that attack them, which you would expect probably France and the Netherlands to do. So I do have my fingers crossed that they might manage to pull off a surprise and get through that group. But I'm sure we will be revisiting the Euros in a couple of months before the tournament takes place. For now, we'll take a quick break and then come back to give the Groundhopper community a little bit of love. Welcome back to part two of this Sweeper podcast, in which we will be talking about ground hopping and then revealing some truly mouthwatering giveaways. But first, the inaugural FIFA series is now over. The winners are confirmed: Algeria, Bulgaria, Croatia, Cape Verde, Guinea, and the Central African Republic. What did you make of this new addition to the FIFA calendar?
Well, you don't really have to ask, coming from my sort of sweeperish perspective. I massively enjoyed it. I thought it was great. For me, it was just, it was like a sort of dream that suddenly there'd just be games between nations you never expected to see meeting at pretty much all times of day. Most of them were visible on streams that worked. A couple of times the streams didn't work, which is a bit of a shame, but it was amazing to sort of be able to spend the middle of your day watching, you know, Andorra, South Africa, or, you know, whoever really. It was a lot of fun.
I knew that Andorra, South Africa one would be the one that stood out to you. One thing that I didn't actually realise until I saw a post on Reddit is that all of the group winners were the highest ranked country. So actually, it wasn't something that produced a large amount of surprises, but it did have some fixtures that you just wouldn't usually see. And I think that is the point that we've both taken away from this FIFA series. FIFA also posted on Twitter about an Australian fan called Aiden who travelled to Sri Lanka to watch the FIFA series, and it was already his 50th match of the calendar year, which approximately 90 days into the year is quite astounding.
Yeah, I couldn't believe this. So I saw a post from him himself, which was quite sort of self-deprecating. He had tagged the post from Twitter and said, you know, FIFA have made this video about me. And I was sort of worried it would be about basically what a sicko I am. and in a way, it sort of was. But it's, you cannot help but admire someone who's watched 50 games this year, because that is an incredible amount, really.
It really is. Well, we thought this would be the time to show some love for groundhoppers. If you're not familiar with the term, people that go to watch football games in many different places and like to tick off new stadiums. And we know that among our listener base, and particularly within our Patreon community, there is a large proportion of groundhoppers. So we're going to talk to some of them in a minute. But before we hear from them, let's reflect on our own sort of ground hopping. How many grounds and in how many countries would you say you've been to see football?
Mine's actually really embarrassing, and I think the reason it's so low is because for most of my childhood, where I racked up the most grounds, or could have racked up the most grounds, I was a Bristol City season ticket holder, so I would just go to Ashton Gate. I didn't go to a lot of away games. Partly it was the expense, and partly just how it starts to then take up a lot of your life if you're going home and away. So actually, my total, the total number of games of football I've been to is probably really high, but the number of different grounds is actually embarrassingly low. I don't have an exact figure, but when you compare it to someone like you, Lee, you've been to, am I right in thinking you've been to every top flight Austrian ground now? So I reckon you probably do more grounds in a season than I did in years. I would have thought in sort of 5 or 10 years.
I think I'd conservatively estimate that I've been to 50 different grounds. I counted the countries, 13 different ones, will be 14 when I go to Malta later this month, which is not bad considering I never used to go and watch live football. And then I came to Austria and a good friend of mine and the co-host of the other Bundesliga podcast, which I also make, Simon, is just an avid ground hopper. And I think he really got me into it because before then I just didn't really do it. It's not something I did when I was younger. But yeah, I've started to get into it. And I can see why it is very appealing to some people. So let's hear now from some of our patrons then who are ground hoppers. The first one we're going to hear from is Leo Hoenig. He's a football fan who divides his time between the UK and France and is one of the veterans of the ground hopping community. This is what Leo had to say.
My name is Leo Hoenig. I watched Hillenbrand in the Southern League as a youngster, but they folded in the early 90s. From the period when Hillingdon folded, right up to and including now, I have been watching, on average, around 150 football games every year, of which 100 are ticks of new grounds under the groundhopper system. When I started doing the grounds, there was no name for groundhopping. There was a short-lived magazine in the northwest of the country called Net Stretcher, which published a photograph of a ground from outside its area under the title Groundhop each month. I then took that name and wrote a groundhopper column in a magazine called Non-League Digest, and it was from there that the name groundhopping has taken off. So my claim is to be responsible for the name groundhopping. But I was certainly not in any way the original groundhopper. There were plenty doing it without a name before I did that column. My groundhopping ventures have taken me to 84 different countries around the world. So it's quite an interesting story. I like to go to the smaller places. So I've been to quite a few of the non-FIFA countries in the Caribbean, like Martinique and St. Martin, as well as having been to some of the obscure ones like Bhutan and even North Korea, which is a story in itself worthy of a much longer segment. What I'd never do is I don't say this was my best ever experience, because so many of the experiences are so good, so interesting. But I would always say my preference tends to be to watch the smaller teams when they have the big matches. The big cup games, the end of season derbies when they're looking for promotion, that sort of game. It brings a lot more people and they regularly get into the ground and it really gives a good atmosphere.
Thanks for sending in the voice note, Leo. I think it's quite amazing that he manages to get to 100 to 150 football matches a year, because that is literally, that's 2 to 3 nights a week over the entire year going to football. Quite something.
It's absolutely amazing, isn't it? It's a phenomenal total. I'm sort of quite jealous of it. It sounds like he has had some amazing adventures in there as well, while also managing to keep up this total.
Yeah, I know that Leo goes to quite a lot of Coupe de France games around the time that we were talking about the Coupe de France when all of the overseas territories got involved last October and November. Leo was posting a lot of photos on the Discord about all these sort of obscure early round games in the French Cup. So amazing to see. And the next patron we're going to hear from is Charlie Craven. Charlie is a Brit who has been living in Romania long term and supports his local team Concordia Chiajna. This is Charlie's groundhopping story.
Hi guys, my name is Charlie Craven. I've been living in Bucharest in Romania for around 9 years now. Before I lived in Romania, I was and still am a Stoke City fan, and all I was interested in was supporting my team home and away. When I moved to Romania, I took up supporting a local team called Concordia Chiajna because I had a couple of friends who supported them, and we used to go home and away with Chiajna, and that was our main hobby. About 3 years ago, I met a friend who was a mad groundhopper, and through him, I caught the bug of groundhopping. I've been going to games from the first league down to the lowest level, which is the fifth league in Romania. And I like to visit as many games as I can, but I visit around 40 new grounds per year. I think the most obscure ground I've been to is Stadionul Vitorul, which is in Scornicești, which is the birthplace of former Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceaușescu. He built his own team during communism and they won the league under dubious circumstances in the 1980s. But shortly after the revolution, they folded. About 3 or 4 years ago, a local guy started the team up again in the fourth division and they played their home games at the old stadium, which is extremely derelict but still in use. And I would recommend it to anyone visiting Romania. 2 years ago, I went on holiday with my girlfriend to Croatia. On the way back, we stopped in Zagreb and I saw a game at HNK Gorica. That night, we drove to Slovenia and stayed the night in Slovenia. The next morning, I woke up and went to Lafnitz, which is just outside Graz in Austria. I saw a Lafnitz play in the second division. It was 11 a.m. kickoff, so the kickoff time was very friendly. And that evening, I drove back to Slovenia and watched Enes Mora play 6 p.m. kickoff. So I ended up seeing 3 games in 24 hours in 3 countries, which is something I was very happy to do.
Of all the things I took from Charlie's voice note, I think going to multiple games in different countries in a particular time frame was the one that appealed to me the most about that. Our friend Slovak Football on Twitter, if you don't follow this account, this is all about football in Slovakia. He did 4 games in 4 countries in 1 day. And it is just something that really appeals to me.
Yeah, me too. And immediately the competitive and slightly nerdy side of me wonders if 4 is the most that's physically possible, because you're going to need countries with very close borders, but you're also going to need fixtures that line up neatly. So it's like really early kickoffs and really late kickoffs. I'd be really intrigued to know, is it possible to beat 4 countries in a day? I can't imagine how it is.
I don't think so. I know that when at Slovak Football did this challenge, the 9 a.m. kickoff was the one that sort of helped him out. That was in Slovakia. Then he did one at 1 p.m. in Czechia, 5 p.m. in Hungary and 8 p.m. in Austria. And especially that last turnaround between 5 p.m. when the game would have finished around 7 and then getting to an 8 o'clock kickoff in Austria. Oof, that's really impressive.
It's really tight. You can imagine there being some real stress about whether you can get there in time. And what I do see in the Grand Hopper community is they take watching a game very seriously. I think a lot of Grand Hoppers only count a ground if they've watched an entire 90 minutes there. So I would wonder if you could rack up more if you didn't have to watch a game. Could you get to 5 different countries' stadiums in a day, for example? Is it the kickoff times? But I'm not even sure you could, in terms of just there can't be that many countries that are close enough to get to 5 countries in a day anyway.
I think you need countries that are close together and one sort of mini or micro state chucked into the mix to sort of make it easier. So I've outlined 2 routes. If we ever did this for the sweeper, I think we should do. So the first one is France, Belgium, Luxembourg, Netherlands and Germany. And they're all very compact and they've all got a lot of football stadiums. Obviously, 5 in 1 day, I think, would be too much of a tall order, but that's one. Maybe one for a weekend where you could do 5 in a weekend. The other one is Italy, Switzerland, Liechtenstein, Austria and Germany, just going up through Europe. And they're not separated by that much of a distance, to be honest.
Oh, they're both lovely tours. I wouldn't mind doing either of those. That's fascinating. Yeah, I suppose Liechtenstein is as you say, just adds that extra country without that much distance. But I'm guessing you also rely on quite good rail networks and that they're going to run on time for these kind of things. Whereas I've always found Italian trains are brilliant, but I've heard German trains can be a bit unreliable. So you could, like, one train delay could destroy your entire plan, couldn't it, on this one?
I think you'd need to drive, to be honest, to do this. Let's move on to our last ground hopper then. Sam Nichols is a PhD student based in Scotland. I've known him for a while, actually, because covering Austrian football, one of the clubs, LASK, they didn't have a Twitter account for ages and they just resisted all of these calls for them to get back on Twitter. Sam took matters into his own hands and founded an English language account for them. And so that's how I first came to know Sam. This is his ground hopping story.
Hi there, Lee and Paul. I just wanted to run through kind of why I do ground hopping, why I love it, and my motivation for doing so. I originally loved doing the Saturday routine of getting up, going to a game. Those Saturday 3 p.m. kickoffs were kind of what I'd love to go to. And as a student, I couldn't afford to go to all the away days all the time. The travel was way too expensive. So I started going to games nearby and got addicted. My uncle introduced me to an app called Footballogy, which is a ground hopping app that shows games nearby. You can check into them, counts the games you've been to, counts the grounds you've been to. And I kind of got addicted from there. According to that app, I've been to 79 grounds in total. I try to get to about 10 or 20 new ones a season. I've already been at 7 already this season. Although it's 16 in total grounds I've been to, I find myself getting attached to a few teams, a few clubs, all that kind of stuff. The most obscure one I've been to probably is a stadium called Sportgelände an der Mainau, the home of TSV Karlsborg. I saw them beat FC Sand 2-1 in the Bayernliga Nord, the fifth tier in Germany. It's about a 35-minute walk from the nearest station, and even then it's not paved all the way. It's middle of nowhere kind of stuff, but great beer, great views as well. It was a lovely day outside when I went, so I'd highly recommend going to that if you ever can. The most memorable ones, probably, I've seen a 10-0 and a 7-3 already this year. Both of those games have been in Fife, so if you ever want to see loads of goals, go to Fife, apparently. But though, I've also seen a 6-3 Bayern second team beat FC Schweinfurt, 6-3. Wonderful game that was. It was one of those games that completely mad, didn't know what was going on, and I loved it. And I've also been to the Budapest derby between Ferencváros and Újpest. Fantastic game, fantastic atmosphere. The ultras were kind of on the top of their game. Great stuff, and great experience too.
Thanks for the audio, Sam. I think one of the things that I really pick up from that audio is how apps such as Footballogy or our friends at Memento really spur people on to tick off new grounds, because it's almost like you make your own list. And I think that's probably a bit of a driving force for a lot of people, because it's quite addictive.
It is. And also, maybe I'm sounding older and older, I certainly feel it, but I really struggle to remember games that I went to even a few years ago now. Whereas if you've got something to log them all on, you have that feeling that, you know, you're not just going to forget that you've been to this ground. You know, you can really go back and revisit them and enjoy those memories again. Because yeah, I find more and more it's hard for me to recall a game I went to in 2010, you know, but I'm sure if I had an app that did that for me, it would be a lot easier.
I had this last year when my New Year's resolution was to use the mindfulness meditation app Headspace every day for a year. I'm into mindfulness meditation. And the thing that kept me going was the app, which kept track of how long your streak was. And, you know, it got to 250 days. And do you know what was my downfall, why I didn't complete the year?
No.
Because one night in August or September, I was tweeting late at night about the Conference League, and it got to midnight before I did my session.
I cannot find a better anecdote to sum up our lives than that. That's amazing. I've had apps on, I've had streaks on things like Duolingo and the one with the owl. That's Duolingo, isn't it? I think. And
yeah,
it gets very aggressive about your streak. It starts to feel like the owl's going to like come in through your window if you don't keep it up. I actually had to stop that one just because the owl was getting so angry with me.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of emotional blackmail by that owl as well, because sometimes it just pops its head up and says, Duo misses you. It's, yes. It's very heavy.
Yeah, it's too much. It's too much, guys.
Well, anyway, that was our Groundhopper segment. Really nice to hear from Leo, Charlie and Sam. So thanks so much for sending your audio in. And if you've got your own groundhopping story, you think you've been to maybe more grounds than some of our groundhoppers, or you've got some unique experiences you want to share, then send us a mail at sweeperpod@gmail.com. And we'll save them for another segment one day about groundhopping. But for now, we're going to move on to the competition phase of this podcast. Bhutan, Paul, is where we're starting this segment. Tell us a little bit of background information about Thimphu City and why the club is relevant to the Sweeper audience.
I have known the owner of Thimphu City, Hishi Sharing. I've known him for some years, and we regularly chat about the club and the challenges of running a club in Bhutan. Thimphu City are currently the runners-up. They were runners-up last year in Bhutan Premier League. Paro FC are their big rivals. And one of the things that I found was coming through from Hishi was a problem in Bhutan is the isolation. It's quite a rare thing for people to visit Bhutan. And similarly, Bhutanese players tend to operate in a bit of a vacuum. There's not that many places for them to go and experience and sort of bring that back to Bhutan. So one thing we spoke about a lot was how Hishi, this you know, lovely, affable Arsenal fan who you know, speaks perfect English, brilliant advocate for his club, but how can he get more people around the world to understand and take notice of his club?
And what was the answer to that question?
He came up with this very ingenious plan. So what Hishi found was that they had released some kits, some football kits. And football kits, as we know, unite people around the world, a bit like groundhoppers. There are football shirt collectors, but everyone loves a good football shirt, especially a slightly obscure one. So what they did was they partnered with Icarus, who probably some of our listeners will know, some won't, but Icarus are a sort of boutique football kit designer. They make beautiful shirts for clubs all around the world. An amazingly quirky and eclectic collection of clubs have Icarus shirts. And they really pride themselves on their designs, which are really stunning and have elements of the culture embedded in them. So they made their shirts with Icarus and found that people were buying them from all over, just all over the world, especially America, UK, Europe. And so what Hishi decided was quite an ingenious thing. He decided that they'd do a competition where one person who buys an Icarus shirt will be drawn to have a trip to Bhutan and come and experience a Thimphu City game in person. And that's what they're going to do.
It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. In partnership with Icarus, the competition winner will get free flights to and from Bhutan, accommodation for a week, plus VIP tickets to watch Thimphu City. Even if you don't win that prize, there are other prizes. Entry to the Thimphu City Overseas Board, which currently consists of a number of Sweeper patrons, a match-worn signed Thimphu City shirt from this season's opening game, and a free shirt from next season of the winner's choice as well. And all you have to do to enter this competition and win one of these amazing prizes is simply to buy a Thimphu City shirt. Is that it?
That is it. That is it. There will be a draw out of all the people that have bought a shirt. I believe if you've already bought one, you can contact the kit manufacturer and they will make sure that you're in the draw. I think if you've already bought the Icarus shirt, you haven't missed your opportunity. You will be included in that draw. That's all you have to do. And what you end up with is one of these really beautiful, rare shirts, and the possibility that later this year you'll be watching football in arguably, you know, one of the most beautiful grounds in the world, which is where Thimphu City play their matches.
Yeah, I've seen that ground. It looks absolutely spectacular. If you want to buy a shirt, you can do that from IcarusFC.com. We'll put that link in the episode description. We'll also put a link in the description for all the details about the competition so you can read a little bit about it. But the bonus is, if you join our Patreon at some point this month, because the competition runs for the month of April, we will send you a code for 10% off your Thimphu City shirt, and you will be entered into the competition twice. So you will essentially have double the chance of winning the prize, which is pretty amazing. And also, you will be supporting the pod and getting a taste of our bonus episodes, our newsletters, our giveaways, our Discord, and all the other perks that come with it. It's basically a win-win for everyone, and most importantly, you will be helping to support a Bhutanese football club that really needs that support and helping to support football in the country more widely. So I think about as good a cause as you can get for a football competition.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, if you want a football shirt that is going to get you noticed or is going to certainly make people jealous and make it very clear that you know a lot about football, a Thimphu City shirt is a good one.
Finally, another football shirt that will definitely get you noticed. In addition to 10% discount off your Thimphu City shirt and double entry into the competition, we have another amazing Patreon incentive to announce. If you sign up to our Patreon before the next episode goes out on Wednesday, the 10th of April, you'll be entered into a draw to win a San Marino jersey, the Minnow football shirt that every Sweeper listener wants to have, and a San Marino scarf too, which, Paul, you secured on your recent trip to San Marino to see the St. Kitts and Nevis game. All of the proceeds that we get from Patreon go straight back into helping us make the show, covering our costs, and securing more giveaways like this. So if you've been thinking about joining the Patreon, do it now at patreon.com/sweeperpod. Another mammoth episode drawing to a close there. Anything you finally want to mention before we round it off?
No, I think that's it. The only one last thing to mention is we spoke a bit about Ocherol, the Mongolian Manchester United fan who is cycling from Mongolia to Old Trafford. Well, he is in the UK and on his way up to Old Trafford as we speak. So a big moment for him, and hopefully we'll have some more news when he arrives.
I saw on Instagram that he posted upon arriving in Dover that he could smell the scent of football in the air.
I don't think that's what it is, Oshiro.
I'm not sure what it was, but I enjoyed the lovely language anyway. But yeah, great to see Oshiro finally make it to the UK. All right, that's it for this episode. We will be back with another one on Wednesday, the 10th of April.